Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Dilip Hero, who assesses the dangerous fallout that he believes will follow a future U.S. invasion of Iraq. Reverend Peter Larman, organizer with the March 5th anti-war moratorium, who explains the objective of hundreds of events across the nation, which activists hope will disrupt business as usual. And law professor Francis Boyle, who discusses his campaign to impeach President Bush. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories. In the developing world, tens of thousands of people are dying from HIV or hepatitis B or C. They are contracting the diseases from syringes that are reused during vaccinations, blood collections, or medical treatments. This is a global epidemic that has been gathering since the 1980s, but only in recent years have public health advocates blown the whistle on the hazards of used syringes. According to the World Health Organization, over 1.3 million people die each year from diseases contracted through dirty needles at a cost of $350 million in medical care. Amnesty International reports that while syringes are routinely disposed of in the U.S. and Western Europe, they are in short supply in much of the developing world, where healthcare workers routinely reuse syringes. In many poor nations, even a 5-cent syringe is too precious to throw away after only one use. In places like India, Pakistan, and Kenya, children are employed to go to dumps and dig through medical waste looking for used needles, which are repackaged at a handsome profit. As Dr. J. M. Mehta of India's Serum Institute observed, the syringes come back on the market nicely packaged, and millions of people in India don't know that they are being injected with needles carrying potentially deadly illnesses. The sex trade in Cambodia is booming, particularly through the exploitation of teenage Vietnamese girls, according to the news magazine In These Times. Data from the United Nations estimate over 200,000 women and girls are sold as part of the sex trade in Southeast Asia. Yet, women's groups and international aid agencies are working toward undermining the Southeast Asian sex trade. Last June, Cambodian police cracked down on two trafficker rings that controlled over 30 girls in the Sue Pak brothel district in northern Phnom Penh. The teenage Vietnamese girls were later deported. And in response to pressure from women's groups, the Cambodian government drafted a new anti-trafficking law, but it was never adopted. In a visit last summer, Mary Robinson, then the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, called for a change in cultural values in Cambodia. She said, quote, "It must become socially unacceptable for a Cambodian man to have sex with girls, 8, 9, 10, under 16, or under 18. While the demand continues, the trafficking of young girls will continue." The grassroots movement for media democracy is starting to get its sea legs, says The Nation magazine. In the face of the media industry's campaign for more deregulation, including abolishing limits on the number of local TV stations that a national broadcaster can own, several thousand citizens have written to the Federal Communications Commission to protest the proposal to weaken public standards for broadcasting. Although many of the complaints focused on Clear Channel Corporation, which bought up more than 1,000 radio stations in recent years, the public critique of media power is growing. As Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, a sponsor of a new reform bill, stated, "The last time I checked, radio waves were owned by the public. We need to remind the FCC that radio is a public medium." Only a few months ago, FCC Chairman Michael Powell, an advocate of media deregulation, commented, "I start with the proposition that the rules limiting media ownership are no longer necessary." In response, activists sent over 2,000 comments to the FCC opposing the rule change on media ownership, fueled by activists affiliated with the Independent Media Centers movement and micro-radio programmers. Michael Bracey of the Future of Music Coalition is upbeat about the growing movement for media democracy. He noted, "It's no longer a foregone conclusion that we're going to see these rules rewritten. It is no longer a foregone conclusion that we are going to have to accept even more consolidation." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
While American and British troops continue to pour into the Persian Gulf region, a diplomatic face-off is shaping up within the United Nations Security Council. The U.S., joined by Britain and Spain, has proposed a resolution that would find Iraq in material breach of U.N. demands for disarmament and authorize war. But France, Germany, and Russia have put forward a competing draft proposal which calls for 4 more months of tougher weapons inspections and declares that military force is not yet justified. In the end, the U.S. must win 9 votes from 15 member nations and no vetoes cast by France, Russia, or China to gain authorization for war. A vote is expected by mid-March. The Bush administration's timetable for invasion has been further complicated by the delay in Turkey's decision to allow some 40,000 U.S. troops to use their nation as a staging area from which to launch an invasion of northern Iraq. In spite of opposition to war by more than 90% of its people, the Turkish government submitted to U.S. pressure in exchange for $15 billion in grants and loans. Menacingly, the Turks have stated that in the event of war, their military will use force to prevent the establishment of any independent Kurdish state. Journalist and commentator Dilip Hero has been reporting on Middle East issues for more than 3 decades. In his latest book titled Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, he warns that a U.S. invasion of Iraq will result in wide-scale human carnage, destabilize the Muslim world, and seriously damage the world economy. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dilip Hero about his deep concern for the dangerous fallout which he believes will follow a Bush war against Baghdad.
The majority of the people living in Iraq are Shia, you know, and they have been nursing their grievance against the Sunni minority ruling them since 1638. And once this pressure is off Saddam's, you know, cruel hand, then I'm afraid this is going to end up into a civil war. So all these guys were rubbing their hands to say, we have got a great access to oil and we are going to rewire this whole country. I'm afraid they are going to come to grief. And they must also remember, and I speak as somebody who wrote a book on the subject, that when there was civil war in Lebanon, it went on for 15 and a half years. And Lebanon doesn't have oil. Lebanon has only 2 or 3 neighbors. Iraq has 11% of world oil reserves. It has 6 neighbors, 4 of which are very big ones, each of which has its own agenda. And if the civil war gets going, which is very likely, then it will go on for years and years in a country which has second largest oil reserves. And can you imagine what will happen to the oil prices and gasoline prices and heating oil prices? But that's all being ignored. It's all being ignored because ultimately this guy has to get even with somebody who wants to try to kill his father. If Bush goes into Iraq, many other things will be neglected. The very fragile peace in Afghanistan, it will break down. There will be a very great rise of terrorism all over the world. And this time, even those groups which are not fundamentalist, Muslim groups who are secular, they will join this particular, you know, terrorist mode. They will turn into terrorists. Finally, you have to ask a simple question. Is terrorism a threat to America, or is Iraq a threat to America? If terrorism is the main threat, then why does the government of USA embark on something which is going to increase that particular threat rather than decrease it?
If you could answer that question, why do you think the United States is ignoring the warning signs that much of the world fears will be the backlash from an attack on Baghdad?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the warning signs, see, then there again the question is, who are the advisors to Mr. Bush? And I don't honestly think that, you know, whatever else one might say for or against Mr. Bush, I don't think he's a particularly articulate or particularly intelligent guy. I don't think he would claim to be a brilliant fellow by any means. And so his advisors are Mr. Cheney, Mr. Rumsfeld, Condi Rice. I don't think Colin Powell has much say. And, of course, the domestic advisors are Karl Rove and Andrew Cord. And 3 people, especially Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz, they are, in my view, power-hungry ideologues. They say we have the biggest military in the world. And we should not be shy of using it. I mean, I'm not saying they're using it in anything, but in this case, they would say because the USA was attacked on 9/11, and therefore we have to counter terrorism. And of course, this long argument, which is, you know, if in future, if A, they claim that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, nobody has found, even if he has, you have to show the evidence. And so that particular drive, which is an ideological drive, which is basically power-driven. We are militarily strong, and we have to show, and we have to put a stamp on the world. You know, we are the biggest guys, et cetera, et cetera. And that is the driving force. Plus, of course, there is a very important other element, which is that Israel must be made secure. Now, if we take Israel now, its neighbors, you know, Israel can take care of these neighbors singly or jointly. You know, its neighbors are Egypt, Syria. Jordan is a cipher in military terms. And if Syria and Egypt were to even combine and challenge Israel, Israel can finish them off. But then beyond Jordan is a country called Iraq. And Iraq, of course, as you know, in the Gulf War, did fire 39 missiles at Israel, and that has not been forgotten or forgiven. And beyond Iraq is Iran. So that particular strategy says that Israel's eastern border must be made secure for all time. And this, again, believe me, is not my paranoia or my thesis. I have exact words of the General Mofaz, who is the commander-in-chief or the chief of staff in Israel. He said, I think about a week ago, that the war in Iraq is going to be very intense, very short, and it will make our frontier secure. These are his words.
What is the view of the United States and its project in Iraq around the world? From your view in London, is the United States seen as increasingly isolated and belligerent in terms of its sole status now as the world's remaining superpower?
Yeah, I think that there have been, you know, quite a few polls in Britain, you know, and when people have been asked who is a threat to peace in the world. And you wouldn't believe, you know. I mean, quite a few times, Mr. Bush has come up above Saddam Hussein, that he is a great threat to world peace rather than, you know, Saddam Hussein is. And, in fact, there was a very interesting piece in yesterday's Times by Régis Debray, who is the French intellectual, in which he's made a very interesting point that this war is being driven by values which are what he called pre-modern. Europeans are more world-weary. They're more pragmatic. They understand things and better, you know, see gray areas of life, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas this president has gone into what Mr. Debray is binary logic, black, white, you know, day, night, that kind of a thing. And so he said that we have a situation where there is the postmodern military machine which is being driven by pre-modern values. Nobody disputes that the U.S. singly can militarily win. I mean, that's not in doubt. Nobody doubts that. But the question is, A, for what purpose, and what happens next? And what happens next, if you ask me, as you probably know, it's not a joke, but it's kind of an anecdote which sums up so much. A surgeon has performed his operation, and he leaves the operating theater, comes out, faces the relatives of the patient, and says, "Operation successful, patient died." So I think that's what, you know, this Mr. Bush is going for.
That was journalist and commentator Dilip Hero. His latest book, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, is published by Thunder's Mouth Press, Nation Books. Protests February 15th brought tens of millions of people in more than 600 cities across the world into the streets to oppose President Bush's plan for a preemptive war against Iraq. Notwithstanding its previous failure to accurately cover Americans opposed to war, the massive demonstrations forced U.S. corporate media for a brief moment to recognize the growing power of the anti-war movement. Now, as the Bush administration makes final plans for its invasion of Iraq, U.S. peace groups are also contemplating their strategy to stop or slow down the march to war. One of the next nationally coordinated actions will occur on Wednesday, March 5th, when a coalition of dozens of groups will engage in what they're calling the National Moratorium to Stop the War on Iraq. Under the banner of No School, No Work, No Business as Usual, religious, labor, and student groups across the country will hold a wide variety of actions, including walkouts, teach-ins, and protests, to send a message of resistance to what they believe will be an unjust war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Reverend Peter Larman, co-chair of the New York City Forum of Concerned Religious Leaders and an organizer of the March 5th moratorium to stop the war. Reverend Larman describes the types of actions being planned and the tactics being contemplated should the White House launch war against Baghdad.
Building on the huge outpouring of resistance to Bush's war on the 15th of this month, the student action network around the country said, let's do something involving student strikes and teach-ins and so forth, culture things, on March 5th to raise a level of student action around the war. And at that point, several other groups, religious, labor, groups of communities of color, joined in and said, let's help you do this, and let's call it a moratorium on business as usual on that day, obviously an echo of the Vietnam moratorium, and let's have a long menu of things that people can do. But whatever the next level is for an individual, if you have only gone to a vigil, maybe this time you should go to a march. If you've been marching, you should maybe do civil disobedience. If you've done nothing at all, you might want to light a candle and put it in. But massive and diverse expressions of opposition on March 5th. For people in Christian churches, it's Ash Wednesday, so they can convert a lot of those services to reconciliation services. There are all kinds of creative possibilities.
What's the message you're trying to send with this moratorium? What do you want people of the country to take note of?
The overall message is that this impending war is the single most decisive and potentially disastrous moment in the history of the last 75 years in the country, and therefore people need to come out while there's still time to say you could call in sick, you could close your business, professors could cancel classes, students could do walkouts, city councils that have passed resolutions could go to the next step, and so forth and so on. The idea is to raise the heat a little bit on the politicians and say, don't let this happen. This is a catastrophe.
Now, who are some of the organizations, local and national, that are involved in putting this this action together?
Black Voices for Peace, the Progressive National Baptist Convention, International Answer, the holding group called United for Peace and Justice, Not in Our Name, Refuse and Resist, Pax Christi USA, a bunch of religious groups, Labor Against the War in New York and in California, the Global Exchange, big group in Southern California called Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, Jewish Voice for Peace, Code Pink, the women who've been in Afghanistan and who are doing these vigils at the White House, 35 groups and growing by the day.
Reverend Peter Larman, where do you think the American public is at this moment when the Bush administration is giving its last shot at the United Nations Security Council to get authority for war? Do you think, by and large, the American people are going to support this war when push comes to shove? Or is there enough doubt out there that will create some backlash for the Bush presidency?
Right now, there's a lot of doubt and a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of feeling that if the United States does this basically unilaterally, it's very dangerous for the U.S. and for Homeland Security. So it's just that practical issue of, you know, how risky this is. On the other hand, you know and I know that when the bombs start falling and our troops are at risk, there'll be a big split. And a lot of the people right now who are expressing questions and resistance will rally behind the administration, and then there'll be also a very strong and probably stronger sense that this is a plunge into the unknown and, you know, a sort of active end-the-war movement. So at the moment, it's clear certainly in the state of New York that the majority of people have serious doubts and reservations, but that could change when the war begins as people rally around the flag.
What kind of strategies are you talking about if and when a war does begin? As you said, you get that kind of rally around the troops, rally around the flag type of reaction. Is civil disobedience going to be a tool that the anti-war movement will use to a great degree if the bombs start falling?
Yes. Given this state of the anti-war movement now, even before military action, I am certain that there will be sustained and pretty extensive expressions of resistance. I mean, if you compare this, I lived through the Vietnam period and the opposition to that. I was a student activist during that time. This movement is way, way ahead of that movement. On the other hand, I mean, I think that the government's preparations to muzzle and stifle and, very actively suppress opposition are also much more advanced. So it's a mixed picture. The son of the USA Patriot Act, you know, the sequel to that was intercepted by the Center for Public Integrity and published, if you read that, you realize that the plans now to detain American citizens and hold them without trial or charge or access to attorneys, those already authorized steps will be redoubled if the Bush people have a chance to put this through. So the question is, there'll be a very active and sustained resistance to the war, but there'll also be an unprecedented level of repression of people who speak out. I mean, I'm given my level of involvement, I fully expect to be in jail for a long time. I just hope I'll be able to communicate with the outside world. Over the weekend in the New York Post, there was an article that attempted to link Fidel Castro, the professor in Florida who was deported, the National Council of Churches, a whole range of people have nothing to do with each other. It's a massive conspiracy, and the headline over it was basically, here's your peace movement, right? The most unsavory people in the world. So it's being set up for a big, big crackdown at the point at which war comes. I'm not frightened. I mean, you can't be frightened. You'd be paralyzed, but it's going to be bad.
That was Reverend Peter Larman, an organizer of the March 5th National Moratorium to Stop the War on Iraq. For more information, call area code 866-54-NO-WAR or visit their website at www.moratoriumtostopwar.org. During recent anti-war demonstrations, signs and chants advocating the impeachment of President George W. Bush have become increasingly prominent. Two sets of articles of impeachment have already been drafted, one by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and the other by Francis Boyle, a lawyer and professor of law at the University of Illinois who specializes in international law. Boyle has drafted six articles of impeachment, accusing Bush of violating the Constitution, several U.S. and international laws and treaties, the United Nations Charter, and even the U.S. Army Field Manual. The high crimes and misdemeanors cited include violations of civil liberties since September 11th, unequal protection of citizens under the law, commission of acts of war without congressional consent, and conspiracy to engage in the use of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. With the exception of references to the September 11th terrorist attacks, the articles are similar to those submitted in 1991 by Boyle and Ramsey Clark, who together called for the impeachment of George Bush Sr. That resolution of impeachment was introduced in the House of Representatives by the late Texas Congressman Henry Gonzalez. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Boyle about his effort and about the broad public support that he says is necessary to make impeachment a reality.
We have the draft bill of impeachment in the hands right now of several members of Congress who are considering it. But we really need everyone to start put pressure on them to get one of them with the guts to put it in the House. We need a million people all chanting impeach Bush. That's what we need. And everyone in the country to mobilize behind the campaign to impeach Bush. If we can get that, we can get one member of Congress to put the bill in. I think we can stop this war.
How would you compare the issues you've raised regarding, I guess, both Bush Sr. and Bush II here, who's in power now, with the actual impeachment of President Clinton?
President Clinton was basically impeached because of oral sex. I mean, it's not even in the same league. Indeed, if you read the impeachment resolution of President Clinton, they did not even have the nerve to go so far as the ending of the Gonzalez resolution against Bush Sr. that said, in all of this, President Bush has acted in a manner contrary to his trust as president and subversive of constitutional government to the great prejudice of the cause of law and justice and to the manifest injury of the people of the United States, unquote. I'm a political independent, by the way. They could not, even with a straight face, accuse Clinton in any of the articles of impeachment of meeting that standard. Clearly, whatever Clinton did, I don't think constituted high crimes and misdemeanors within the meaning of the Constitution. Although I did at that time organize a campaign to impeach Clinton for the right reasons, which meant the bombings of Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, and Pakistan, and then using these bombings to detract and undermine and draw public attention away from the domestic scandal concerning Monica Lewinsky.
And how far did that go?
We got a lot of support. Several hundred professors signed a petition to that effect. There were some ads and whatever. But this is a different matter. Ramsey Clark has also started his own campaign. Ramsey and I worked together with Congressman Gonzalez the first time. And he, too, has articles of impeachment that he's drawn up. And, you know, he takes a somewhat different approach than I do, but that's fine.
What are the differences? Could you say just briefly?
Well, Ramsey has decided to go back and deal with everything since September 11th up until today and the whole war on Afghanistan. You know, and that's fine. I agree with what he's saying. I just decided to focus on preventing this war against Iraq. That's my objective. To prevent the war against Iraq. What motivated me to launch my campaign last fall was this call for preemptive warfare made by Cheney and Wolfowitz and the others. And my objective is to stop this war against Iraq. And I think if we make it clear, oh no, if you go to war against Iraq, we're going to do our best to impeach you. And there are tens of thousands of people out there chanting this. I think that'll have an impact.
Are you worried at all, given the usurpation of powers that you enumerate in the articles of impeachment, are you worried at all that someone could come calling on you?
Sure. Yeah. I'm fairly well known. That's all over the Internet.
And has anyone come to visit you from the government yet?
Not yet, no. But, I mean, you know, look, the question is this. With all of the defects and problems of the United States of America, and I've spent 25 years fighting them as a lawyer and a law professor, we're still the oldest republic in the world. And it is time for all American citizens to stand up and fight to keep a republic here. Do we want a republic, democracy at home, and a peaceful foreign policy? Or do we want an empire abroad and a police state at home? And people are just going to have to decide. Some judge is not going to do this for you. Some member of Congress is not going to do this for you. The American citizens will have to do this for themselves, or else we're going to see the end of this republic.
That was Francis Boyle, international legal scholar and drafter of articles of impeachment against President George W. Bush. Read Boyle's January 17th article about impeachment online at www.counterpunch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.